This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. We will have some thoughts, many of them from you, on this somber day, 50 years after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. Dallas holding memorial services and ceremonies today and throughout the weekend. Events that began with a presidential visit to Texas and ended with a funeral in Washington, D.C., watched by the entire world. If you have stories you want to tell of where you were on that day, what you remember, what you felt, we'd love to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll also have two very different looks at the U.S.-Mexican border region this hour, how events on one side of the border are transforming culture on the other side, and in one case, around the world. We begin this hour in Texas, but far from Dallas, in the town of Harlingen, Texas, right on the Mexican border. We're going to talk to a doctor who has had to close his clinic because of a Texas abortion law affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court that requires doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. Dr. Lester Minto's clinic, Reproductive Services of Harlingen, up until a few months ago, performed some 1,500 to 2,000 abortions a year. There are still some court challenges and tests of this law that could come as early as January, but for now, Minto says he is essentially unable to serve the largely Latina clients who rely on him in a state where it is increasingly hard for poor women to get a safe abortion.
I serve a population here in South Texas that's predominantly, I would say, 98 to 99% Hispanic. Many, many of those patients don't speak English. Many of those patients, at least 50% or so, do not have the proper documentation to leave the Rio Grande Valley. In other words, they can't go over about 40 miles north. So these are the kind of people that I've been seeing now for the last 30 plus years.
And the Texas law says that you have to get attending privileges at a nearby hospital. I mean, if that population is important to you, you better go about doing that, right?
That's what they request. However, that's a catch-22 type situation. Most of our hospitals here in the area are religiously affiliated hospitals, and as you know how the feelings regarding abortion and religion go, it's virtually impossible to get privileges. Over the years, I've attempted to obtain privileges and been denied, and then over the past month or so with the instigation of these laws, one of the providers who filed was involved in the lawsuit tried to get privileges for some of us in that field, and we were all turned down.
But have you tried at a specific facility since this law was passed, you personally?
Not personally, no. And if it were possible, believe me, I would have it. However, the sheer process takes at least 3 to 6 months. It's not something you can accomplish in a week or two. It's not as easy as going to a store and filling out an order and getting something. It's quite an involved procedure. And just to give you an example, one of the things that they ask for is your vaccination record as a child. I'm 65 years old. I mean, that's been 60 years ago. So these are the type of documents that they require.
And you perform something on the order of 1,500 to 2,000 abortions each year at your clinic?
That's correct.
And have you ever had a situation where someone needed to go to a hospital emergency room because of some complication?
Over 30 plus years, of course I have. And I could limit that to less than the fingers on one hand. And when those situations did occur, because I know all the local gynecologists, we work hand in hand together. I just call one of my friends, tell him what was going on, and the patient would be very well taken care of, as good as any patient anywhere.
And just to be clear, Dr. Minto, I mean, in the state of Texas, just like anywhere else, if someone is in a life-threatening situation and you go to an emergency room, they're not going to turn them down just because you don't have attending privileges, right?
That's correct.
Now, I'm just looking at the map here down near where you are, and it does appear that there is, pretty good facility about 2 miles from you, Valley Baptist Medical Center and the Regional Academic Health Center, which is a teaching hospital, doesn't seem to be religiously affiliated. Any way you could create some sort of affiliation with them?
Well, I can tell you this, that when the RAC, as you call it, started, I approached the director, who was an acquaintance of mine, and suggested to them that I would be more than glad to teach some of the residents how to do what I do. And the answer that I was given at the time was we didn't want those services. And so I just backed down. There's not a great desire to learn how to do abortions. Unfortunately, we have made abortions and religion synonymous. And that most of them don't desire to have that. I've had demonstrators at my house, at my office, demonstrators following my children around, yelling things at them, and no one should have to go through that.
Now, what's your recommendation to the people who you're no longer going to be serving?
Well, I do tell them to be careful, to act wisely. There are other alternatives that people here are utilizing, such as obtaining one of the medications that's used in the medical abortion. They can obtain that over the counter in Mexico. And so that is available right across the river. And now I'm even beginning to notice it show up here on the streets. So I don't suggest it. I know they're going to do it, but I do not suggest it, and I don't recommend it.
Why are you doing this? Because, you know, the anti-abortion folks look at the numbers at your clinic and go, this is exactly the kind of business we want to get rid of. They would call you a slaughterhouse.
They do, and I have seen nothing that the anti-abortion people provide to decrease the number of abortions that are needed. I myself would have to say, and I often tell patients this, that I wish they didn't have to come and utilize my services. I can find something else to do. But nothing is being done here as a society to cut down on the number of abortions. I stand 100% for women's rights. I would object if a group of politicians, and I always call them old white men, I would object if a group of old white men told me what to do with my reproductive organs. I don't see where they have the right to tell women what to do with theirs. I have a house full of daughters. I raised my daughters. Their mother died when they were little. So I raised three at the time, three little girls, grew up, three Hispanic girls, never got pregnant. And in this part of the world, three out of five Hispanic girls are pregnant before they're 20 years of age. And I did that through judicious use of birth control, being open with my daughters, being realistic with my daughters. We just need to be better parents.
All right. Dr. Minto, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Lester Minto owns and operates Reproductive Services of Harlingen, a clinic in South Texas that up until earlier this year performed abortions. Some very strong opinions from one doctor in Texas, but when does a question about the morality of abortion in a nation where abortion is legal become the basis for a legitimate regulation for doctors? The practice of medicine is subject to all kinds of regulations at the state and federal level. Where does this Texas law requiring an abortion doctor to be affiliated with a local hospital fit into the overall regulatory environment for doctors? Jessie Hill is an expert on the law, regulation, and medicine. She's a professor of law at Case Western Reserve University, and she joins us from the studios of WKSU in Akron, Ohio. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So what is the precedent for legislatures and state, you know, lawmakers essentially intervening in the practice of medicine in all realms, even outside of abortion?
Well, it's kind of complicated. The traditional understanding has always been that states in particular are there to look out for patients, for citizens' health and safety. So that's kind of a traditional role of government. That's what government does. And since about the late 19th century, states have really been involved in regulating the practice of medicine specifically. So things like licensing, certain requirements to practice medicine, other creating state medical boards, things like that, and of course drug regulation, which happens also at the federal level, all kind of dates back to that turn of the century, late 19th, early 20th century era. So there's nothing particularly exceptional about states getting involved, about the government having some say in regulating medicine. Of course, we want them to keep quacks out of the business, right, and unsafe medications off the market and things like that. But there's really kind of this, from a legal perspective, a tension between the state's traditional power to regulate medicine and healthcare and things to keep people safe, and this individual right, constitutional right to choose reproductive health care, that kind of pulls in the other direction.
Well, how does a law professor, and how does the law really handle that tension in the sense that if people are going to mount challenges to this law, I suppose the counter argument would be whatever a doctor may feel about being regulated, there are all kinds of regulations, and you may not like this one, but you're going to have to live with it.
Right. Well, in the abortion context specifically, the Supreme Court has tried to sort of strike this balance between recognizing the state's traditional power and recognizing that there there is a really important individual right involved here, autonomy right to make decisions about, you know, your not just your reproductive health, but also whether to become a parent or not. So it has developed a very complex doctrine around abortion specifically, and has said that the government can regulate abortion just like any other medical procedure unless it puts what's called an undue burden on women's access to abortion. So that is usually the main question in these kinds of cases, is whether a particular regulation is what the court refers to as an undue burden on the abortion right.
And so the question for the doctor we just spoke with is whether it's an undue burden for his largely Latina clientele there in South Texas. In terms of it being an undue burden for him as a doctor, he probably has very little standing in that regard.
Yeah, that's right. That's one thing that's sort of interesting about the whole way that this jurisprudence, this area of law has developed, is that the emphasis has been on women's access and not on the burden on physicians or on physicians' right to practice. So the question often just boils down to, you know, is it burdening women? And that's a hard line to draw. You know, I think, you know, once you start having a situation where you have to travel 300 miles or 100 miles or something to reach a provider, you know, I think you're in that domain.
Feminist critics of the Roe v. Wade decision, ironically, have suggested that the amount of text in that decision that really talks about the practice of medicine, as opposed to purely talking about a woman's right to choose, invites legislatures on some level to intervene and control and regulate this process of what physicians will do. Yes?
That's right. I mean, some feminists have suggested that the court would have been better off if it had emphasized that this is really a women's equality issue. You know, I think you could come at it from another angle as well, though, and say that if the court had really recognized instead that this is about a right to make healthcare decisions autonomously, just like the right to refuse medical treatment, the right to, you know, we talk about the right to die, that, you know, had recognized a really robust right in the doctor-patient relationship, that would have been another way in which doctors might have been protected from some of these really onerous regulations of the practice of medicine.
Well, questions that will come up with the courts in this term and subsequently. Jesse Hill is professor of law at Case Western Reserve University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For the past week, like so many, we've been remembering the death of President John F. Kennedy. In Dallas, we heard from a choir that put a speech the president was never able to give to music. We talked to a witness to the assassination, and we've heard your memories. Bill in Minnesota.
I was on a chartered U.S. Army troop train traveling to Fort Carson, Colorado. Our first knowledge of Kennedy's death came from a soldier hearing the news on his pocket transistor radio. Needless to say, the mood ranged from somber to tearful panic, especially from those who knew that Fort Carson was just a pit stop on the way to Vietnam.
Tell us what you recall about that day 50 years ago at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. As we noted yesterday, they did it. The U.S. Senate has changed the rules of the road, a 52-48 vote ending the use of the filibuster to block most presidential nominees.
Enough is enough. The American people's business is far too important to keep falling prey day after day to Washington politics.
President Obama may be happy about the change, but this historic rule change casts out a number of unwritten rules that govern what parties can or cannot do when they are not the majority in the Senate. And that could further poison the chemistry between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate going forward.
The majority leader said we had set the rules for this Congress. Well, obviously, that was a commitment not kept.
That's a angry-sounding Republican Senator and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Joining us now to help assess what this change will mean for the Senate is Vin Weber, a former Republican congressman from Minnesota from 1980 to 1993, now co-chairman and partner at Mercury, Clark & Weinstock, the political consulting firm there in Washington, D.C. Congressman Weber, welcome back to the program.
John, good to be with you today.
So this is a big deal. What would it have been like if Republicans had made this change back in your era?
It is a big deal. It's an historic change. I don't think it's likely to be reversed. In fact, I think it's likely to accelerate over the next several years. It would have been a very bad deal. The Reagan administration, for instance, would not likely have achieved much of what they achieved because the polarization of the Congress would have been more complete. I think that's how you have to look at this. I have to take very slight issue with the introduction. I think you said that this will poison the relationship between the Republicans and Democrats in Congress. What I would say is this is a result of a poisoned relationship that already exists between Democrats and Republicans in Congress. It's sort of the ultimate surrender to polarization, the concession that we cannot work together as parties, even in the United States Senate, where the rules have pretty much forced that on the two parties over history. And it's a concession to reality, but it's in some ways a very sad day.
Well, that's why I'm dying to have this conversation with you, because I'm kind of scratching my head a little bit in the sense that we talked with a historian yesterday who's looked at the filibuster going back a century, right. And his notion was that you think the Senate is dysfunctional now. Once they do this, watch out. And I'm just wondering what your assessment of that is.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you have to think about, I don't want to get too theoretical with you, but there's democracy we define very simply as majority rule. But the truth is, in most organizations, most boards of directors, nonprofit organizations, even often local government, people try to achieve not simple majority rule, they try to achieve something close to consensus. If you're on the board of your local church, you don't like to have a 5-4 vote to build a new church parking lot or something like that. You want it to be unanimous. That's what we usually try to seek. The House of Representatives has never been like that, but the Senate has. The Senate has tried to say somewhere in our democracy we want to urge people towards something closer to consensus than simple majoritarianism. And we've thrown that, we've given up on it. We've said we can't run the government that way, whatever the reasons, deep polarization in the electorate, changing nature of our political system, all the reasons we've argued about the last few years for polarization. We've now said that is the reality. The reality is there's no longer a chance of a consensus, and we're going to practice simple majoritarian democracy in this country.
Well, let's take the presidential nominees piece out of this. I think Americans have a certain and a well-founded frustration that instead of debating great issues of the day, there are all these symbolic little proxy wars going on that involve things like presidential appointments. Is there a way to create a legislative set of rules where, all right, if you want to have balance on the D.C. circuit, for instance, X number of Republicans, X number of Democratic nominees, write a law and do something like that? Let's make it explicit and keep the presidential appointment process out of this kind of circus.
There are structural fixes such as the one that you just described that might do something. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure that I would like that. I'm a Republican. I do not support this president. On the other hand, I don't want to permanently weaken the presidency and take away from whoever is elected president the ability to try to shape the country's destiny according to his own views. I mean, I just have that view about government. And so we would be trading off. We would be looking at a short-term problem, an intense and acute short-term problem, but trading away a long-term institution, which is the strength of the presidency.
Would you want to be in the Senate right now under these circumstances? Any thoughts there?
I would not. People are going to have to come there with a different attitude. They're going to have to. It's going to be more like the House. They're going to battle it out day after day. And I think that this is. I understand this applies only to non-Supreme Court appointments, but I think that's only because it doesn't, frankly, serve the Democrats' purposes at this point to go further. There's not a Supreme Court vacancy on the table. They can't pass legislation until there's a Democratic House of Representatives anyway. But as soon as either party now finds it in their interest to go further on this rules change, whether it's because the Democrats have a Supreme Court vacancy to fill or because the Republicans take control of the Senate in the next election, if that should happen, I think you're going to see this precedent now extended further to legislation and to all appointments.
So if there's a Republican majority in the Senate, this will be accelerated regardless?
That's my guess. I've talked to a lot of Republican activists the last you know, 24 hours, or I guess even less than that, since this decision came down. And one thing I hear regularly from them is, this is a horrible, awful thing, but at least it's going to help us finally get rid of Obamacare. Meaning, if and when the Republicans take control of the Senate, they will now be able to pass the repeal of Obamacare or the undoing of Obamacare with a simple majority vote.
All right.
And I think the pressure to do that will be so overwhelming should the Republicans take control that all these arguments about the need to maintain precedent of the filibuster are going to go out the window.
All right. Stay tuned for that. Devin Weber, former Republican congressman from Minnesota from 1980 to 1993, now co-chairman and partner at Mercury, Clark & Weinstein. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John. Good to be with you.
Later this hour, we're going to reflect on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy 50 years ago. We've been collecting your memories all week. We've been sharing those memories. Have your say at 877-8-MY-TAKE or follow us on Twitter. That's at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. This week, an organization representing the 30 Republican governors in the nation has convened in Scottsdale, Arizona, the Republican Governors Association. It's a GOP powerhouse. Overrepresented in state houses around the country, the GOP is challenged in urban centers and in national polls right now. But the RGA has a new chairman, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie.
Two obligations. I have two jobs now that I'm undertaking. My first and most important job is being governor of New Jersey. And I'll continue to make that my number one priority. And number two is being chairman of the RGA.
But being chairman of the RGA raises New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's profile. Covering the Scottsdale, Arizona meeting is Matt Katz from New Jersey Public Radio. Matt, welcome.
Thanks, John.
So is the RGA chairmanship really the number two job, or is it maybe the number one job if Christie has any chance for a national run in 2016?
It is certainly the key right now to a presidential run for Christie. He's going to now have the opportunity to travel to not only those 30 states to defend Republican governors, but to the 36 states that have governor races next year. And he's going to have tens of millions, if not over $100 million in campaign funds in which to direct to these guys. And that'll help build up favors for a 2016 run. It'll help him build relationships with conservative voters. He'll be out there campaigning. He'll be on local TV. And it's all expense paid by the Republican Governors Association.
And tell me about the Republican Governors Association. Unlike the congressional sort of fundraising organizations in the Senate and the House, the Republican Governors Association is attracting more and more sort of fundraising efforts on its own for a variety of reasons. What are they?
That's right. After the 2010 Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which loosened rules on political spending, the Republican Governors Association has been able to raise unlimited amounts of money, and they have minimal disclosure requirements. So they've more than quadrupled the amount of money they get per year after that. And they're getting money from some of the biggest Republican names in the country, like the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, the casino mogul, who gave more than any other person in the 2012 presidential race. There's a lot of similarities between the kind of people who spend a lot of money on presidential runs by Republicans and donors to the Republican Governors Association.
Is it unfair to say that Chris Christie is basically running his own super PAC with the Republican governors there on the marquee?
Certainly a lot of people were saying that this week, but from the podium when the governors were taking questions, it was all about 2014, not 16. We're not talking about 16, they said. Christie said if anybody's talking about 16, they're doing so at their own peril. And he's just concentrating on 14. And you know, in large part, he is. I mean, if he has a good showing in 14, if he shows that he's got coattails and influence and can win some seats that are not Republican now in state houses, then that gives him some wind at his back going into whatever's next for him.
Well, some of that wind came from Ohio Governor John Kasich, who certainly describes Chris Christie as being an influential person in the state of Ohio, where John Kasich is running the state house there. Listen.
He came out to Ohio during my last campaign. People just loved him. You know, he said, you know, if you don't elect this guy, I'm coming back here in New Jersey style. They liked it. And, you know, people like him. And he has one other thing going for him. It's called celebrity. In case you haven't noticed, that's a big darn deal in America today.
So it would appear that Chris Christie has a lot that he can redeem from his leadership of the Republican Governors Association, not just money, right, Matt?
That's right. And these guys know that he's an effective campaigner. I mean, he might be the most effective campaigner they have right now because of that political celebrity and because of his ability to sort of crystallize political messages. I mean, this guy just won by 22 points in a blue state, New Jersey. So these guys know they need him next year for sure.
New Jersey Public Radio reporter Matt Katz covering the Republican Governors Association meeting in Scottsdale, Arizona, the RGA run by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Matt Katz, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Movie Friday with Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, the host and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, Kristen, culture producer for The Takeaway. Welcome, folks.
Happy Hello, Friday, John.
So happy Friday. I'm a little tired. I took a busload of 12-year-olds to the big blockbuster of the weekend, oh. Hunger Games Catching Fire. Let's start with that. Here's a clip.
You haven't hurt people, Katniss. You've given them an opportunity. They just have to be brave enough to take it.
We have to go, Gale, before they kill us. They will kill us.
What about the other families? Huh? The ones who stay. What happens to them? People are looking at you, Katniss.
I don't want anyone looking to me. I can't help them.
I'm telling you, this movie is kind of like Survivor meets Celebrity American Idol. I could not make heads nor tails of it. My kids absolutely loved it. Christian, what do you think?
You need to see the first one in this trilogy. This movie franchise is fantastic. I love it. It's post-apocalyptic. This is dealing with a very sad future where we're living with a totalitarian regime, where children are being forced to fight to the death in arenas on national television. And in this movie, the second installment, we're dealing with the aftermath of last year's Hunger Games. Katniss Everdeen and Peeta Mellark came out triumphant in the first one, are now being forced to go on a national goodwill tour around the districts.
So and, celebrity is the poke of... It's like the celebrity tour, but it's the grimmest celebrity tour you've ever seen. Everyone's covered with mud and angry.
Yes, and,
more
and,
mascara than I've ever seen. They must have had a $3 million mascara budget in this film.
Yes, but you know what? This kind of desperation means they need a revolution, and Katniss Everdeen is giving them the hope to start this revolution.
Right,
that's
well,
what's happening.
A lot of hope from Kristen Meinzer. Rafer, what did you think?
You know, I liked the first one quite a bit. I thought it was really interesting and really edgy for a teen flick. This one, a little less successful. I think the problem for you, John, is you were plopped in midway.
And
it's a
middle
movie.
I'm a geezer. Just rule me out. But my kids said just the opposite. They said this one was much better.
Oh, I found it
much better than the first one.
I found it slower. I found it really slower. And I just don't get excited about all the torn between two lovers stuff in this movie.
Whereas I agree with your kids, John. This one actually looks better and is better.
I knew that you would. Well, it doesn't matter what I say or any of us say. It will be the big movie of the weekend and will carry straight through the holidays. Here is an inevitable movie with an inevitable star, Delivery Man, starring Vince Vaughn as a 40-something underachievers who donated a lot of something or other to a sperm bank. Listen.
Certain complications arose, which meant that for a period, Mr. Grabowski-Levitt gave your sperm to all the women in his clientele. You have sired 533 children, and 142 of them wish to know your identity.
What?
You are the biological father of 533 children.
Couldn't wait for Father's Day on this one. Kind of a sweet holiday story. What do you think, Rafer?
Inevitable is definitely the word. I mean, there are very few surprises. Not a lot of suspense in this film. No knuckle biting. You know exactly what's going to happen. You can see the heartwarming coming a mile away. But I have to say, in the end, it kind of won me over. I think Vince Vaughn, his charm is still potent, haha. And I think he kind of carries the movie. And ultimately, even though it's very syrupy, I kind of bought it.
Kristen, you hate movies with men as the stars. Okay, let's just say that right at the top. There's no possible way you will like this.
I love men. And I actually think Vince Vaughn's a lot less irritating in this than he normally is. He doesn't yell. All of his lines are not just him having a hysterical meltdown. But I do think that this movie's not as funny as it should be. And
right.
That's the biggest drawback for me. Your one job in this movie, heartwarming is good, but your job is to be funny, Vince Vaughn, and you're just not delivering.
I'd love to see that on the poster, though. Kristen Meinzer says, not as irritating as usual, Vince Vaughn. All right, what's on the podcast this week, Kristen?
So we are dealing with a listener who wants to know, why aren't there more movies out there with female action stars? And we are going to be giving her a giant, giant, giant list to choose from of some of our favorite movies that actually do have female action stars.
If you liked Catching Fire, here's some movies
to choose
from.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, and Kristen Meinzer, takeaway producer, also with the Movie Date podcast. Have a great weekend, guys. Thanks.
Thanks, John.
You too, John.
The drug wars in Mexico have made the border community of Juarez a killing field for murder and violence and dance. If that track makes you feel like dancing, consider the lyrics. With an AK-47 and bazooka on my shoulder, cross my path and I'll chop your head off. We are bloodthirsty, crazy, and we like to kill. We are the best at kidnapping. The music of Narco Corridos. Is it a bold celebration of violence or an anthem of drug lords advertising their own reputations? Among Mexicans and Latinos in the U.S., narcocorridos are hugely popular. Its rise tracks directly with the homicide rate in Juarez, 300 homicides a year in 2008 to nearly 4,000 today. Artists like Commander and Buknas de Culican singing about death and the narcos behind the drug wars, like the cowboys and outlaws of another era. The new documentary, Narcocultura, juxtaposes this flashy life of narco-corrido artists with the lives of individuals and families personally affected by the drug war's destruction. The film is directed by award-winning photographer Shaul Schwartz, who says the story inspired him to make a leap as a storyteller.
My background is of still photography, and this conflict was raging out of control. And in 08, I embedded myself in Juarez and couldn't stop going. The idea that I would fly to El Paso, back then the safest city in the U.S., and literally walk across to the most dangerous city in the world at the time just blew my mind. And that's when I met Edgar Quintero, the singer in Bucanas, and they were always performing so close to the border, and I would kind of zigzag across the scene, and to see a club at the same day you may have seen a murder scene. And to see a club full of people chanting these songs, parading around with fake bazookas, it just kind of blew my mind, and I couldn't tell that story in a still picture, when that's kind of how the movie was born.
Part of this film is the narrative of how youth culture grows up. There are children in this movie who are terrified of being murdered. There are kids who know everything there is to know about guns and love to talk about it. And then there are kids who want to be
narcos.
A hip-hop artist and narcos. Yeah.
What these kids do is they go to the clubs and they want to be narco for a night. There's even a term for it now. They say narco platicante, which means narco talker. That everybody kind of acts up as a narco, except the next day they got to go and work. And
it's like a Disney ride that simulates the experience.
Absolutely. It's the best reference I think Edgar told me one day is like, think that it's a weekly Halloween party, except everybody dresses up as the favorite new narco. And what really drew me is, how did we get to this place? And the more time you spend in the scene, the more you actually understand it. When you see how the political reality of this drummed up drug war has not gone anywhere and in fact failed so bad, when you see all the kingpins still running around, and when you see the opportunity of Mexican kids, you know, a kid in Juarez typically has a family that works in local factories called maquiladoras. And when he says, what do I do next? He looks at these kids rolling around in their trucks, getting buried in mausoleums. The girls in high school want to meet a narco, a son of a narco. It's just what they say, la moda now.
Handfuls of $100 bills. What do the artists think they're doing? Is it just making a living? Is it just sort of living off something that they can't really control? Is it Wild West?
I think it's a little bit of mix. Edgar does admit to being a product of this culture as well. At the end of the day, when he gets pushed, he's like, look, I try to sing love songs, I try to sing other party songs, but they don't sell. We deliver what the crowd wants. And maybe he's letting himself off the hook a little easy, but to some degree it is true. It's become a very lucrative scene. A big artist like Commander will sell out 15 to 20 shows, perform to as much as 50,000 people, get paid up to $100,000 a show. They're no joke.
A message that makes it to the suburbs of Des Moines, Iowa, or Chicago?
Oh, absolutely. Huge and many places beyond belief, much more remote than the ones you mentioned. This music definitely has legs.
You spend a lot of time in Juarez and in places that are in real close proximity to this brutality and violence. Is part of this art a way of celebrating having survived?
I don't think that the art is celebrating the survive. I think there's a disconnect in many ways, because I remember when I would come back from Juarez and meet Edgar, the singer in the movie, he would commonly say, show me the Juarez stuff. I want to see how it really looks like, because he really is from L.A. He does not know the streets well enough. He could sing about murders all day, but he doesn't know how it feels or look like. So there is some disconnect across that line. But at the same time, corridos are popular on both sides of the border. Even Richie, the CSI worker that I cover in the movie, at the end of the day, loves corrido. And one day I was there, and the scene is in the movie. He invited me to a Mother's Day celebration at his grandmother's house, of all people. And soon enough, after the band played a couple of love songs, the corrido started blasting. And I was shocked. And Richie was dancing with his grandma to these very violent lyrics. And I think that's what we don't really kind of digest. This genre and this topic is really a big chunk of Mexican culture today. It's not Pancho Villa anymore.
Which motivates me to ask, does it shock you to have the CSI Richie singing the violent lyrics with his 80-year-old grandmother? Or does it speak to you, too, because of your experience in Juarez, your proximity to all this violence?
Does it speak to me? You know, it doesn't speak to me. I won't. You won't really find me humming this music all too often. But I've become a lot less angry about people who like it or why it's out there. I'm very acceptive of it. What does bother me is kind of how we on this side have tucked it all away, and it just, we have this amazing way of making it feel all far and disconnected to us. And when you cover the story, when you see how this genre is born, you understand how much we're in the center of it. And I would be very upset if people saw the film and just kind of blamed the Mexican kids instead of kind of thinking bigger picture.
Shaul Schwartz's first feature-length documentary, Narcocultura, premiered at Sundance this year, and it opens in New York and Miami this weekend. Shaul, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
A thought about the calendar 50 years ago today. 112263. A haunting number for a haunting day. An event so familiar and yet so stripped of its bare facts that simply hearing that sound of an 8mm projector, for those who were alive 50 years ago, it brings back the pictures. Low-resolution pinks and greens, a car, crowds in Dallas, no sound. Then something is wrong. Then everything is wrong. The famous film eventually stops. But time has not.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
Down a long 50-year corridor, 112263 becomes 112213. There had been three presidential assassinations before this one, but JFK was there and then gone, on camera and in real time. Everyone found out about it at nearly the same moment. Everyone experienced it in a collective national moment like none before.
We just have a report from our correspondent, Dan, rather in Dallas, that he has confirmed that President Kennedy is dead. There is still no official confirmation of this, however. It's a report from our correspondent, Dan Rather, in Dallas, Texas.
My name's Jim. I live in Seacliff, New York. I was 17 years old at the time. I was leaving school. We heard about it on the street because everybody was buzzing about it. I got on a subway. I was very, very, very upset. And I remember a man looking over at me and saying, "Nothing's going to change." And I, in all the years since, I thought of that man, and I thought of how wrong he was.
What is there to say about this day? People in America have asked themselves for a half century where they were, and everyone knows where they were.
My name's Arlene from Portland, Oregon. I was an information operator at the telephone company the day that he died, and we were taking calls, and all of a sudden, everybody looked up. There was no calls, and that never happens. Everybody just looked around, and then someone said, Kennedy was shot. Out of 17 years working there, it was the only time that ever happened.
A nation's breath stopped 50 years ago, and the world watched.
My name is Edith Miller. I'm calling from Little Rock, Arkansas, but I'm from Scotland. And I remember as a child in elementary school, I was homesick that day from school. And I remember my mom brought in the wireless, as we had at that time. And even in Scotland, I remember hearing the message and crying. I mean, it was such an amazing thing.
Memories frozen in time, but time did not stand still.
I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute.
I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
The new president taking the oath of office there, who could not have been more different. He took over, Lyndon Johnson. Time moving on seemed the strangest of all to me. I was a first grader back in 1963, watching all of the grown-ups falling apart, crying and hugging each other, staring at televisions for days. On the 24th, we were in my basement. My grandmother Hockenberry was with us folding laundry. My parents revered JFK, but my grandma, on the other hand, was an anti-Catholic Democrat hater, openly intolerant, racist. She would tell us that she believed the Catholics had guns in their basements, preparing for some kind of war. We were watching the old smelly black and white TV. They were bringing Oswald into the police station in Dallas. It was happening live, which I remember was amazing. My mother and I and my grandmother watching as if we were in someone else's dream. Oswald, right there, the guy who shot the president. I remember my grandma shaking her head and saying, "You know, I bet somebody is going to just shoot him." And then someone did. Jack Ruby fired off a bullet. Oswald died. Live, confusion, pandemonium, once again. My mother looked at my grandma, astonished. I thought she was psychic, but she was just thinking probably about all the armed Catholics she presumed were ready to go to war against anyone who would kill the first Catholic president. As a first grader, all this blended into the crazy dream. Everything had changed, was changing. Did my grandmother know Jack Ruby? Was a war about to start?
Hello, this is Jim Higgins calling from Eugene, Oregon. The day that JFK was shot was my first day as a draftee in the Army. I was standing outside the barbershop waiting for a haircut. Somebody came out and said that the president had been shot. Ended up in the barbershop watching that while I got my first buzz cut in the Army. I thought we were going to war with somebody.
The caisson turns at the spot where Delaware Avenue, Constitution Avenue, and Pennsylvania Avenue comes together.
The memories and fears from that day are so blunt, they're almost without meaning. John Jr.'s salute of the coffin of his daddy. The images of the horses they used to move the coffin down the streets of Washington, D.C. The hundreds of thousands who came to file by the body. The music they played the day of the funeral. An unfamiliar new president trying to console a nation.
My fellow Americans, all I have, I would have given gladly not to be standing here today.
Hi, this is Ruth from Fort Worth, Texas. I was taking the Constitution test given to all eighth graders. I was on question 98, which read, name the order of succession to the presidency of the United States. To this day, I can't do it. It hurt me so deeply. I still can't answer that question.
From 12:30 p.m. on November 22nd in Dallas until the end of the day on the 25th, all around the world, a collective national moment for a nation that didn't know itself very well as a new superpower, united suddenly by these new electronic media, a nation with a future no longer Camelot, and with a past that had never been anything like Camelot.
George Robson from Petoskey, Michigan, and on the day of the assassination, I was in the eighth grade in a Catholic school, and Mr. Gunderson, our teacher, said, President Kennedy's been shot, and it's the first and only time in my life that the air was completely expelled out of my lungs, just like somebody had punched me in the gut.
We can wonder about the punch this nation took 50 years ago, but we can't know much about what might have been. There might have been no Vietnam War.
The Viet Cong simultaneously attacked just about every major city and town in South Vietnam.
We've had two prolonged wars since that one. The attacks in 2001, which may be the closest thing in living memory to JFK's death. Was all of that inevitable? Would Kennedy have kept any of it from happening? In the end, the meaning, like the soundtrack, falls away. Only images of something now far away. A number, 112263. Americans ask themselves where they were 50 years ago. The harder question is where have we been these past 50 years? We're still working on that one. Thanks so much for listening today. Share your memories of that day 50 years ago, where you were, how you and your family reacted, recovered. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to facebook.com/The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.